Thank you, Richard. And I'd like to thank Ann and the committee for inviting me here today, and you people for putting up with, for putting Sandy and I up. Maybe you put up with us too, I don't know. Hi, my name is Chuck O'Neill, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I go to Saturday morning Al-Anon group at 1609 John Avenue in Superior, Wisconsin. It's the same building that I started going to Al-Anon in 16 years ago in May. And I've been pretty much going there ever since. I've had to change home groups because of my work situation. But that's all right. When I go to Al-Anon in Superior and Duluth, it's pretty much when I go there I know quite a few people. Okay, Chip, here we go. Doggone guy, he picks on people, doesn't he? That's poor Al-Anon, just poor little wimpy Al-Anon people, huh? Who's that guy? All right. You know, our Saturday morning meeting is blessed in that we've got about 10 guys that attend that meeting. And we go to breakfast before the meeting. It's the meeting before the meeting. And our waitress calls us the moms. That's men with mustaches on men. And that group of about 10 guys, they call me Tiny. So, Chip, if you want to come and rob us and put your hands down our chest and down wherever other places you said, we won't be writing out any checks. Somebody might be checking out, I don't know. Oh, I'm pretty nervous right now, so it's going to get me a while to get on my feet here. I'm certainly grateful to be here. We've had, I've heard you guys say I haven't had to take a drink in 16 years and all that. And I haven't had to lose my serenity in probably, what time did I step in the water in our bedroom? About 10 o'clock last night? Our bedroom, the air conditioner sprung a leak, and we were kind of waiting around for a while. So we changed rooms this morning. It's really, you know, Fort Walton Beach is a very difficult place to get to. I mean, last year we were supposed to come here, right? Everybody that's sitting here was supposed to come here last year, and we couldn't make it. And you know, you think you get asked to speak someplace. They usually ask you 6-8 months in advance, but my God, this has been a year and a half to get me nervous here. So Sandy and I got on that plane in Duluth, Minnesota at 7:30 last night. Or, I mean, 7:30, I'm losing track of time, Thursday morning. And we had stopped in Minneapolis, St. Paul, at the airport and changed planes. Then we got on a plane bound for Memphis. And the pilot told us it was going to be rocky, but I didn't realize how rocky it was going to be. We landed in Memphis. We had 8 minutes to get from one end of the Memphis airport to the other end of the Memphis airport, and it's kind of shaped like a horseshoe. And we looked like O.J. running through the airport and ran the old commercial when he was doing that stuff, you know. And we did it. And we got up in line. We were the third person from the checkout or the attendant there, and we're waiting in our line. All of a sudden, we heard this sliding noises, and they were putting cancels across our flight. The two flights to Pensacola were canceled. The flight to someplace in Mississippi and someplace in Alabama were canceled. They had tornado warnings in Memphis. And I'm thinking, God, if you're going to have a tornado someplace, you want to get the hell out of there. You don't want to get stuck there. And we had a whole lot of options that we could do, like come here this morning and spend 2 days in Memphis, try to find a ticket on another airline. Both flights for the next day were booked up. And we're standing, she's standing right in front of us, and Sandy and I are together, and we've got our tickets there. And I felt apprehensive, and I felt anxious. And we were talking to this lady, and this is what the program has done for Sandy and I. And I haven't introduced Sandy yet. She's sitting over there, and I'm not going to embarrass her by having her stand up. If you want to see who she is, look for the nice, beautiful woman next to the tall guy. That's my wife. We've been married 30 years. But anyway, we're talking to this ticket agent, and she's being very nice, and she's got total control. You know, she punches the little buttons, see? There's a guy next to us, and his wife talking to the ticket agent, and he is insane. Insane. And his wife said, I ain't going to stand here if you talk like that. Get the hell out then if you don't want to stand here. Go on over there. Get out of here. And he's saying that to her. And we're standing there, and we've got these slim options, and all of a sudden the ticket agent says, well, you can find a motel. There's a convention. You might not find a motel. We thought, well, we'll call somebody in AA. They said it was an act of God. Those people need Al-Anon. Northwest Airlines needs Al-Anon really bad. That was an act of God, they said. Anyway, all of a sudden the light came on. We're not going to Pensacola anyway. We're going to Fort Walton Beach. I says, well, how about a flight to Fort Walton Beach? Click, 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 click. Oh, yes, we have lots of room to Fort Walton Beach. So we got to spend the night in Memphis, caught the 9 o'clock flight here to Fort Walton Beach, and I'm telling you, Memphis, Sandy and I had a delightful time there. We ended up staying at a hotel, which was quite expensive, but which was a beautiful place. They were having a convention there, a Southern church convention, and there was a lot of people of color there. Sandy and I are not used to that. And it was elegant. It was wonderful. It was great. We really, it was a new experience for us. And it opens up avenues. You guys open up these avenues for us. We went across the street to go to Denny's restaurant. There was another one next to it, catfish cabin or something. And I like catfish. The only time I get to eat is when I come down south to be with you folks. You order catfish up in Wisconsin, they cut the sole off your shoe, throw it in the frying pan, and that's your catfish, you know. We went in this restaurant, and it's filled with the people from that church convention. And again, I know now what it's like to be a minority, you know, because the only white people in that restaurant were Sandy and I and the waitresses. And I said, Sandy, you talk about role reversal. I mean, here it is. And we were astounded. The elegance and the gracefulness and the camaraderie and the love that just was flowing in that restaurant. And then back in that hotel. We got on the airplane and come down to Fort Walton Beach, and Rich picked us up at the airport, and it's just been great. Oh, by the way, we got settled in the hotel. The damn fire alarm went off. I said, are they trying to tell us something? You know, we get here and the air conditioning leaks. Anyway, the theme of your conference is love and be loved. And thank God that Al-Anon and thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because today I can say I can love and be loved. Because Chuck Lemieux was not able to show a lot of love. I thought I was, but it wasn't the kind of love that I learned in this program. Enabled me to call my son, who turned 29 last night. It was his birthday, so we called him from the hotel room. And we talked for a few minutes. He says, you're very lucky people. Yeah, we are. It also enabled me to talk to my son, and just as we were hanging up, he said, Dad, I love you. He said it first. Dad, I love you. Not before. Not before this fellowship, and not for some time into this fellowship. It's really great. Now, God usually tells me when it's time to sit down because he's got my nose start running. My nose has started running already, and I ain't started yet. Okay. It's 20 minutes after 2, and I don't say that for you. I say that for me because they got a clock up here. This doggone alcoholics and people, they think about everything, don't they? They got this big clock, but I also see it's got glow-in-the-dark hands, so if I start going too long, I'll still be able to see the clock. This is a wonderful conference. I told some people that have been here before that Sandy and I were coming down here. We told them that last year before your hurricane. And they said, you people are wonderful people, and that it was the best conference that they had gone to in some time. And I agree. This place is great. You've got a lot of humor. There's a lot of friendliness. The hugs with the little sticky things that are sticking all over, that's just great. I had to use some of mine, by the way. My son says a man will be attentive, and I had to put these stickers on something so I know the difference between one thing and something else. I put the stickers on them so I could tell them apart. I got to do that kind of stuff. You know, it's Al-Anon's got to keep track of things. That's why I've only got a couple stickers left. And I love the history on the flyer. I don't know if you guys do that all the time, but if you don't, please do, because the history on the flyer is very, very interesting. Where you guys started out with this roundup. Before, when I was a little kid, I've always been skinny. I've always been tall. Tall, skinny, wore glasses almost since the day I was born. I always felt insecure. I grew up in a home where there was alcohol, and I don't know whether any members of my family were alcoholic or not. Alcohol is just part of life. I grew up in Superior, Wisconsin. There was 25,000 people in 89 bars. And there's a lot of railroad workers, a lot of elevator workers, a lot of shipyard people. It's a blue-collar town and a union town, and you drank and you talked shop and you went to union meetings, and that's just the way it was. It took me a few years now before I realized this, that when my mom and dad, when we got in the car and we drove to Ironwood, Michigan, which was 100 miles away from home, it took us about 3 hours to get there. And when I started driving there, it used to take us an hour and a half. I couldn't figure that out. Well, Sandy and I were going to Michigan one day, and I said, well, me and mom and dad used to stop in Iron River right there at that place, and we got to Ashland. I said, well, we used to stop there at that place on the way. We just kept stopping at these bars, you know, on the way to Ironwood, and it was, that's just the way it was. I wasn't unhappy. I don't remember being unhappy. We had a loving home. I love you was said a lot. We used to go to the bars, and my brother and I would play pool and eat chocolate bars and drink Coke. It was fun. That's just the way it was. That's the way we grew up. We'd go in the back room, you know, they were all family bars. Nice little family bars owned by family people. Sometimes they lived upstairs. This one particular bar, we'd go there on Sunday, and in Wisconsin, the bars weren't open on Sunday. And my job when we'd go to this family's place was I used to sneak downstairs and I'd crawl on my belly to the cooler and get the beer out of the cooler and bring it back upstairs again. It was just like I was undercover, you know, like I was in the CIA or something. I was sneaking through this bar, just knowing the cops were going to be looking at me and stuff. It was exciting. That's the way I grew up, thinking there was nothing wrong with it. And I drank when I got older. I'm not going to say that. I'm not like Larry said something about too drunk, too dumb to get drunk. Well, no. I got drunk lots of times. I got drunk a lot. I had a car accident and I almost killed myself. I got 48 stitches in the back of my head because I was dumb and drunk. And I don't know why I'm not alcoholic today, except I don't have a phenomenon of craving. I don't know what that's all about. I was a people pleaser. I like having people happy with me. I have a good sense of humor. I like people laughing with me, not particularly at me. I grew up in a home where there was a lot of laughter. My dad was a practical joker. He used to embarrass the hell out of me when I was a kid growing up. You know, he'd play these goofy tricks on everybody, and I just knew they thought that my dad was a big dummy, you know. But that's, you know, I grew up in a happy home. And I don't remember feeling sad. I just remember feeling kind of out of place. Being skinny and wearing glasses, I wasn't allowed to play football, and I felt set apart from that. That really bothered me, that I wasn't allowed to play football. And the jock that we had for a football coach or for a gym teacher in junior high school, he made a point of that I wasn't playing, and it kind of set me aside even further, and I just kind of crawled into that shell a little further. I'm not going to go through my childhood or my growing up. It really doesn't make much sense. I'm just a normal guy, a normal kid, and I just grew up in a drinking home, and I went in service, and I was in France for 2.5 years, and I got out and started hanging around the bars. I started hanging around the college bars. I never went to college. I just hung around the college bars. And I suppose you know why. Superior was 21-year-old law there. You couldn't drink unless you were 21. But out in the county, it is what we called it, you could drink when you were 18 in a beer bar. So we used to go out there and drink. And one night, a friend of mine called Dale. Dale called me up and he said, would you like to go out tonight? It was a Wednesday night. And I said, yeah, sure, we'll go out. So we went out to Clara's Tavern. It's a beer bar. And we sat in the booth. And at this time in Superior, the men sat at the bar and the women sat in the booth. And it was against the law for women to sit at the bar. So anyway, we're sitting at this booth, and I never really thought much about it, you know, why we were sitting there. But anyway, Dale's girlfriend, Nancy, came walking in with this stunning-looking woman. And I said, now, this is back in 1966. So the hairdo was, you know, I mean, she kind of had this rubber thing sticking up. I told her the other day, I said, you know, it reminded me of a water buffalo because that thing just kind of parted in the center and it came out like this. But I thought it was beautiful and it was frosted, you know. It was kind of tan and brown and blonde and stuff like that went through it. And Nancy came in with this woman and they, or girl, He sat down with us. Man, was I nervous, because I was, you know, I was 23 years old, and I had spent some time in the military, and I got nervous around pretty women, you know, and I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know what to do, and I thought, oh, damn, I wish I would have stayed home and watched Bandstand, you know. And we were introduced, and a couple weeks later, I asked Sandy out to go double dating, and we went out on a double date. But, you know, in the meantime, it was like I couldn't get her off my mind. She was on my mind constantly. What happened, you know, when we were sitting, she was sitting across from me, and I think she touched my ankle with her foot. And I had dreams about that for all 2 weeks, you know, I thought about that sensuous touch on my ankle with her foot. And back in those days, that meant something, you know what I mean? Perhaps I got a granddaughter from a casual acquaintance now that my son gave us. So, you know, that, things back then were a little more complicated. But anyway, we went out. And we just went out. I mean, it was like, you ever watch those commercials on TV? They don't show them anymore, but it's like in slow motion, you've got these two flaxen-haired beauties, you know, running together, a blonde-haired guy and a blonde-haired woman. They're just slow motion, running through this field of green, you know, And they all of a sudden they meet and they entwine and they just fall into the hay, or so to speak, you know, fall and they just fall together. That's Sandy and I. I mean, well, you know what part I mean. We just kind of meshed like fingers into a glove. We were two sick people looking for one another. And after that, I'm sure that we did go out with our friends, but it's like we were a pair. Oh, I didn't go out with my friends a lot anymore. Sandy didn't go out with her friends a lot anymore. We just stuck together. And she was just the most beautiful thing. And I was in love. And I didn't think I deserved her. I couldn't figure out what she saw in me. Later on, she says, if you hear Sandy tell her story someday, she'll talk about how I made her laugh. And that was really important to her. And that she decided that she was going to marry me. Just that plain and simple. And thank God she decided it, because I probably wouldn't have made the decisions. I didn't like making decisions then, and don't like them now. The way we got engaged was that we were going out of town for a wedding, and now this tells you when we were going together. She was going to sleep with my mom, and I was going to sleep with my dad at this motel, see? And she wouldn't go with unless I got her an engagement ring. So I went and got her an engagement ring. That's just the way it was. I found out later on that Sandy was supposed to meet somebody else. It wasn't supposed to be me that was with Dale. She had a blind date with another guy, and that guy, for whatever reason, didn't show up, and I was a replacement for a blind date. Now, that does not do things for your self-esteem. When I found out that not only was I a blind date, I was a replacement for a blind date that didn't show up, you know, that helped me out a lot. Well, we got married. You know, we drank. I mean, we just drank. Alcohol was part of our life. Everything we did had alcohol involved with it. And we partied, and we went to movies, and everything we did. And it was sex. It didn't matter what it was. Alcohol was part of that relationship. We got married, and we had a son 9 months later, the one that just turned 29 yesterday. And then we had a daughter on the next New Year's Eve. And about 4 years, 5 years later or so, we had a son, another son. So we've got three kids. Things started getting kind of bad there. Sandy turned 21. You see, she was 19 when we got married, and I was like 23. Sandy turned 21, and it seemed like this is the thing that I see in my mind, and this may not be the way it happened, because one of the things Al-Anon has taught me that is that my reality isn't necessarily the way things happen. It's also taught me that the reality ain't the way the alcoholic thinks it's happened either. Sandy and I have agreed to disagree on many things, and it's helped keep us together, believe me. AA and Al-Anon, as it says in Living with Sobriety, doesn't make any claims to be the thing that keeps a relationship going. Relationship together. I mean, we know several people, ourselves included, that have nearly or have separated or divorced in this fellowship. It's not an uncommon thing. It's just something that happens. And later on in my story, I'll tell you a little bit about that. But things started going downhill. The drinking increased, and I was working like afternoons and midnights and days. I was doing swing shift work, and that's pretty nasty. And you know, a lot of times I would go to work, and most of the time I went to work, and I would worry all night long. I operate a piece of machinery it's a forklift. That's what it is. And I'm a professional. I'm a professional forklift operator. You guys didn't think I was a professional, though, did you? I have a career. And less than 2 years from now, I'm going to retire from that career. But anyway, I'm motoring through that warehouse, and I'm thinking about home. What's going on? Are the kids okay? Is she home? Is she out someplace? I wonder what's going to happen. When I get home, is she going to be hungover? Am I going to beat her home and have a babysitter sitting there? Those are the things that went through my mind. And you know something? 99% of the time when I got home, there was nothing wrong. That didn't happen. 99% of the time. Didn't stop me from worrying about it. I always worried. I was nervous all the time. And I wasn't too pleasant of a person to live with after a while. Sandy, well, and if I mention Sandy and anybody else by name in this, I'm not trying to make light of them. I'm not trying to drag them down or anything, but I'm going to share with you my experiences and my behaviors because of somebody else's alcoholism and because of somebody else's drinking. It's how I reacted to that. Sandy was out one night, and I was home babysitting with the kids, and I had kind of an idea where she was. I thought I knew where she was. So the kids were sleeping. We had two at the time. You know what the heck? They're in bed. It's 2:00 in the morning, something like that. You know, they're going to sleep all night. And man, I just played this game with myself. I made it to that doorknob so many times, I don't know. I was going to go find her. I had a good idea where she was. Finally, I just went through that door. Once I had my hand on that doorknob, I was out. I got my car. I drove downtown. I found out where she was. And I turned around and came home. Yeah, what did I accomplish? I left those kids home alone. That's a terrible thing to do, but I had to do it. I had to go find her. I had to know where she was. I was going and the scenarios I played in my mind, this is what I'm going to do this time, this is what I'm going to do that time, and if I had done this last time, she wouldn't do this time. Paul was the same. And we made promises, and she made promises, and I chose to accept those promises. You know, she didn't force them down my throat. And I've learned today that an alcoholic makes promises, he means them. Until that booze gets in there, that beer gets in there, then promises disappear. But I chose to accept them. I really did. I got to a point where we wouldn't go out together anymore. I understand now, because of what Chip has said, I understand that there are some alcoholics in this room, and you guys may not understand what I'm about to say. But if you Al-Anons agree with me, you know, I think I'll know this. Sandy and I went out to a dance one night. This is just a room about this size, up on the third floor, this kind of a granite floor. And sometimes she could drink two beers, sometimes she could drink a tall pack. And beer she always drank, that was it. Nothing else, she just drank beer. Old Milwaukee, top shelf stuff, you know. Old Milwaukee, give me the old mill. And they had these big, huge glasses like they got back there at this wedding dance, these big, huge glasses of beer, and we had a few of those. And Sandy, I could see, this is what happens. Now, you alcoholics pay attention. At a certain point in the evening, an alcoholic's eyelids will go, and they'll just come halfway down like broken window shades. And they always do. And then, you know something scary is happening, because all of a sudden they go back like this, like they're going to be able to see out from underneath those window shades. And they just kind of sit there and they'll look around, you know. And at this night that happened, and I'm thinking, uh-oh, here we go. I didn't have any Al-Anon, but I had recognized this symptom. And I told our friend Karen, I says, you know, we got to get out of here. Something crazy is going to happen. Well, Sandy, when you see her, is about 5'6", and she fits right about here. Sandy, when we danced, Sandy always led. And we used to dance around the dance floor. We'd waltz around. We never bumped into anybody. We never stepped on anybody's feet. We never elbowed anybody. It's like she had radar. We were up in the airplane. We could see those tugs pushing those barges, you know, up the river. That's what she was doing with me. She would just push me around that dance floor. We were so graceful. But this time I said, Sandy, do you want to dance? I said, okay, good. That's great. We got up and we started dancing. This time I led. And I danced Sandy across that dance floor all the way around through, like, this room, down three flights of stairs, and I danced through the car. Yeah. The heck, that's what a guy has to do, you know. So I got in the car, and we drove home, and then I did something that I always, you know, that was common. It wasn't out of place for me. I just picked her up, and I threw her over my shoulder because she was out by this time. And I walked in the house, and I opened the front door, and the babysitter was sitting there, and said, "Hello, Jerry." And, "Hi, Chuck." "Hi, Sandy." You know, I walked her up the stairs, you know, carried her upstairs, put her to bed, and then I would leave to bring the babysitter home. And a couple times I went back out, too. But, and I leave that, those three kids, home alone with a passed out person, passed out body. And that's terrible. But I had to do it. Something else that I used to do, and I'm not particularly proud of this, and I've been sharing this for a few years from the podium here. Something else I used to do is when I get home, I take advantage of Sandy. Because, you know, she was my wife. And you know how that goes. And she's passed out, and I want what I want, so I took it. Man, I ain't proud of that. Because that's molestation. There was nothing consensual about the sex we had. But you see, I never figured Sandy appreciated me unless she was drinking. I never thought she was attracted to me unless she had alcohol in her. That was my perception. And I'm not saying she ever even told me that or intimated that that's what it was. That's what I had in me. I was not a person that somebody could be attracted to unless they were drunk. And that's the way our life continued. I'm going to share something with you, and you know, it seems like I'm telling you a lot of things that I'm not very proud of, but I wasn't very a good person to be having. I had a lot of pride, but I didn't have to do things to be proud of. I'm sitting home alone. That's where I was going with this. Yeah, I'm sitting home alone, and I just quit going out with Sandy because it always was a fight. So she went out by herself. And then I sit home. And you know, Pyrex coffee pots, those, I don't see very many of them anymore. I start brewing a pot of that stuff on the stove, and I'd leave it sit on there, and I'd sit on the couch, on the arm of the couch, and I'd look out the window. You know, I'd see it when the car was coming home, and I'd be drinking that coffee all night long. I'd be putting that coffee on. I'd be getting them coffee things, you know, because that stuff just used to cook and cook and cook and cook. Yeah, ooh, when she gets home, I'm nailing her to the wall this time. You know, I've got it. It's written in stone. You know, I'm going to get her this time. Car pull up, you know, and we live on two dead-end streets. We live on a corner of two dead-end streets. You'd be amazed how much traffic that goes through there at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. Because I'd get up in that chair, and I'd have to sit down. I'd get up in that chair, and then every time I'd get up, the dog would get up because she'd figure she's going outside to pee, you know. And I got mad at her, and I'd kick her, and she'd wag her tail at me because she's an Al-Anon dog. So eventually she'd come home, and I'd, you know, here I am. I'm 200, well, now I'm heavier than I was then, but I'm over 200 pounds, and I'm looking out the window, see this little lady coming up, sometimes with the help of her friends, into the house, and I'd run upstairs and jump in bed. Yeah. Yeah. I'd go to bed, and I'd hear Sandy come up the stairs, and sometimes she'd go in the bathroom and do those disgusting things that alcoholics do in the bathroom, and sometimes I'd go in there and rub her back. You know, oh, poor thing. Try to get that head down that toilet. Oh, I'd love to have done that. See, I had a love-hate relationship with my wife. I loved her, but I hated her. And I hated her that night, and I loved her in the morning. And I'd help her out, you know, and we'd finally get her to bed. She always kissed the kids goodnight. That was disgusting, too, you know. Because here I am, you know, here I am, I'm not drunk, I probably haven't even had a beer, you know, and here she's drunk, and who do the kids think is crazy? You know, she brings them candy bars and kisses them goodnight, and a few hours before that, I've got the kids in bed, and up north, in the wintertime, it gets dark, and man, it's great, because you can get them kids in bed 4:35 at night. Yeah, and then you can commence the pacing and cussing and stuff and looking at yourself in the mirror and hating what you see, you know. And sitting by that telephone because it might ring. She might call to say she's coming home, or maybe they'll call and say she killed herself or something, you know, and that was my fantasy. But I get those kids in the bed, and then my daughter, she's beautiful, little Chrissy, you know, she'd come to the top of the stairs, 3, 4, 5 years old. Dad, there's a boogeyman in my bedroom. So I go upstairs. Oh, I look around, look in the closet. You know, there's no boogeyman around here, Chris. Tuck her back in bed. Where's Ma? I don't know. A few minutes later, half hour, whatever, some span of time, she'd be padding those little footsteps to come to the top of the stairs. And, Dad, I have to go pee. So I go upstairs and put on a pot, you know, and get her back in bed. Well, where's Ma? I don't know, Chris. This would go on, you know, a few times during the night, and finally I'd go up there, she'd be calling me up there again, and I'd get her in that bed, and she'd say, Dad, when's Ma coming home? I'd say, shut up! Look at me. I'm 6'4" tall, I weigh over 200 pounds, and I'm screaming and spitting in the face of a 4-year-old. Telling her to shut up. I don't know where in the hell her mother is. I don't know what in the hell I'm doing here in this place. Why should she ask me those questions? Who's nuts? Who does that kid think is crazy? My son, who I talked to on the phone last night, just said he loved me. Cowering in the corner of the bathroom, and I'm standing over him, and I got my fingers shaking right in his face. And I used to be one of these people. Well, I'd poke his chest, and I'd poke his shoulder, and I'd poke his arm, and the kid used to cringe when I'd come. I'm just shaking my finger in his face. You know what he was crying about, cowering in the corner of the bathroom? He was crying because he said he was afraid of me. Damn if he's going to be afraid of me. I'll show you. And I have him right in that corner. Who are the kids, when they're growing up, who's nuts? This is the alcoholic that comes home and says, hey, kids, here's some candy. Or is it this big old ugly guy with his mouth wide open spitting and I'm shaking his finger and stuff, you know? And one night Sandy's out drinking. It wasn't all ugly. We used to have some fun, you know. One night Sandy's out drinking. She used to go bowling out to this bowling alley. She'd drive across this old muddy bridge. And I used to dream about her driving her car. I'd fantasize her driving into that river and drowning. I mean, that car just disappearing in there. Because if it got down 6 inches, they'd never see it. And I fantasized about that. And I hated her. God, I wish she was dead so I could marry somebody else and have a better life and all this kind of stuff. That was my fantasy, see? But she always came home. So, anyway, she was all bowling one night, and the kids were me watching TV, and Sandy had a bottle of Coke in the refrigerator. It was always there on Fridays for Saturday morning. It was her bottle of Coke, and she'd come home with them rusty pipes, you know, on Saturday morning. She'd come stumbling down the stairs, and she'd chug a lug that bottle of Coke. And she still drinks that stuff. I don't like it myself, but anyway. So we're kids are sitting around, you know, and I said, you guys want some pop? Yeah, we want some pop. So I went and got that bottle of Coke, and I opened it up, and Rick's kids are sitting here today, and I said, I'm going to say something. I don't want you doing this to your mom or dad or nothing, but this is the story I'm going to tell. I gave them kids Coke. We passed Coke. I even had some, and I don't like it. So you know what happened? We ended up drinking that whole bottle of Coke. So I went and got the coffee that perks on the stove, you know, all night long. It had been morning coffee, and I filled that Coke bottle up full of morning coffee, put that top back on there and stuck it back in the refrigerator. Man, I couldn't wait till Sandy got home. And the next morning, me and the kids, we had our breakfast, and we went to wake Ma up, and usually I would let her sleep for 3 years. I didn't want her to be out of bed, you know, but that day I was anxious for her to be up, so we took some yarn, and we went upstairs, and we were tickling her face with yarn, and she was slapping herself and everything. And finally she got up, and she come downstairs and headed for that refrigerator, man. Pop the top in that Coke bottle. Go, go, go. And I, you know, there was children present, but still the language that was just spewing forth, the guys in the warehouse couldn't do justice to what was being said there. But as much as I hated her at night, I loved her in the day. And sometimes it was like I could love and hate her in just a spin. Love, hate. Love, hate. There's a state park in, close to our town, and I remember one time on a Sunday morning after I hated her the night before, we were walking down that state park hand in hand, loving one another. I loved her so much. Holding onto that hand, walking down those nature trails. God, we were in love. And the next night I hated her because she was out drunk. Who's crazy? Who in the hell is nuts? The alcoholic? Who just kind of seems to float along drinking and doing whatever, you know, they make you mad sometimes, but they just have fun. God, they had to go to the Stanley party, had to go to the Tupperware party, had to go to the PTA meeting. One night Sandy came home and she said, this was like about 3 o'clock in the morning, she'd been drinking with her sister over in Duluth, and Duluth's about 80,000 people, I guess. She said, Chuck, I tried to kill myself tonight. And I burst out bawling. I said, you tried to kill yourself. Don't you, you know, that's crazy, that's insane. Don't you know that the kids love you and they need you, and don't you know your mother and dad love you and they need you? I went through this whole litany of our family, including myself, how we loved and we didn't miss her and blah, blah. And this is incredibly selfish of you to do something like that. What about me? Where was my selfishness? And I thought to myself, you big phony. Here you're telling her all that stuff, but I meant it. I swear I meant it. But yet I still hated her. I had been wishing she was dead. She comes home. She says, I tried to kill myself. I say, you're nuts and selfish for doing that. You know, who's crazy? The alcoholic or the other guy? Who's nuts? She wasn't the same person when she was sober as when she was drunk. And I couldn't figure that out. How could it be two different people in there? She would come home sometimes, and I remember laying my hand on her side, you know, and go to bed, and she'd be laying there. And because of the amount of caffeine I had in my blood, she would kind of just go to bed. And alcoholics, when they crawl in bed, and you guys don't know this. You alcoholics don't know this. I mean, you crawl in bed, and all of a sudden you just go, and they're just dead to the world. And, you know, it's just... Yeah, you, no wonder some of these people can talk about doing strange things to alcoholics, and they don't know anything about it. But on the other hand, here I am laying there, and my eyeballs are putting circles on the ceiling, like one of them lights that tells the time, and I'm vibrating from all this caffeine. That vibrating is probably what put her to sleep. And I'm not sleeping at all, but I'd put my hand on her hip, and I'd just be home. And it was just this flip-flopping back and forth. And I just didn't understand what was going on. I remember one night we were talking about drinking, talking about staying out late. And she said, you know, Chuck, if you were half a man, you'd call me up and tell me to come home. Well, see, you guys can sit in here and laugh about that, you know, and it is funny. But I didn't see anything wrong with what she said. You know, she's right. Okay. She says, I'm going over to Canaries, and I'm going to have a few beers. And at 10:30, you call me up and tell me to come home, and I'll be there. Oh, never mind. I know most of you guys probably even hadn't heard this story before. It's got to be unique. It can't ever have happened to anybody in this room. So anyway, I'm pacing the floor, man. I was a good father that night. I didn't get mad at anybody because 10:30, I'm going to be doing some telephoning. 10:30, come along. I'm on that phone. I call Canaries Bar. It's about 3 blocks from home. Call Canaries Bar. Let me talk to Sandy O'Neill. Sandy who? And I hate bartenders. I mean, I used to be one, but I can't stand them anymore because of that night. Sandy Hugh, you're just smart alecky. And finally she comes to the, and I could hear her laughing coming towards the phone. Ooh. If hands could reach through the telephone wires, you know. She comes to the phone, and, hello, I says, it's 10:30. So what? Well, you know, you said you'd come home. You'd call me at 10:30 and I'll come home. She says, I'm not coming. Now, our stories vary a little bit here because I said I hung up on her. She said she hung up on me. But I don't want to get into Sandy's story, but she said on the way back to the table, she had already conjured in her mind a story she was going to tell her friends, the audacity that her husband called her at a bar. And it was her idea. Damn alcoholics. Anyway, that's the way it was. I was like Charlie Brown in the football. You know, in the fall of the year, you watch Charlie Brown. Every year, it's in the paper where they, Lucy Van Pelt. Lucy Van Pelt holds that football for Charlie Brown. Go ahead and kick it, Charlie. No, you're going to pull it away from me. No, I won't pull it away from you. Now, I don't know where Lucy Van Pelt lives, but if she's going to AA in your area, let me know. And I think Charlie needs some Al-Anon too. But invariably, he swallows it, and this year it happened. He went running after that football, and she pulled it away from him. She said, I didn't want to disappoint you. She pulled that football away, and he went, keister over tea kettle, landed down there, and that's the way I was. Chose to believe it all. Everything, every time it was going to be different. One day we were sitting on the couch and we were looking at one another, and we didn't particularly care for one another. We hurt one another. We weren't good to each other. We were stuck in a relationship that, I don't know, it was just, we just existed. I didn't hate her, but God, I wished it was different. And she didn't hate me, and she wished it was different. She said to me, "Chuck, I don't know if I can quit drinking. I don't know if I can come home on time." And alcoholism never entered into it. It just wasn't a part of it. You talk about denial. Denial is a family disease. Yeah. One night Sandy came home drunk, and she said something to me which stung me really bad. And I backhanded her with my left hand, and ironically my wedding ring hit her in the eye. And her eye just was instantly swollen. And she had like a marble under her eyelid, it looked like, and it was all black. And that was Saturday night. And Sunday we went to my mom's for dinner. And man, that's all that was on my mind, was that eye. Because, I mean, you couldn't miss it. Looked like she was wearing an eye patch. Nothing was said about that eye. It was like the emperor's new clothes. We talked about football. We talked about the weather. We talked about everything. Nobody mentioned the eye. And it never has been mentioned. Except by me at the podium here. Denial. It's just not me and her. It's everybody in the family just kind of looks the other way. Maybe it won't happen again. Maybe it's going to be different tomorrow. One of Sandy's relatives went into treatment. And part of the treatment philosophy at that time was to have the family members go to Al-Anon. And I don't know if it's still that way. I noticed that treatment center philosophy changes quite a bit. But at this point, anyway, she brought home some papers to fill out about the, I was going to say incarcerated, but about the person that was in treatment. And then she had to go to Al-Anon. And I'm looking over because, oh, here we go, Chip. I had to make sure she did this right. You know, she had to fill this questionnaire out right. So I'm watching over her shoulder as she's filling out these questions, and I'm thinking, golly, they pertain to our life. Our life was on that piece of paper. She's on that piece of paper. And anyway, she filled it out, and she started going to Al-Anon. She was at a Tuesday night meeting one night, and I was sitting home with the kids, which I didn't think was very bad. I didn't mind sitting home with kids if I knew she was at Al-Anon, because I knew it had something to do with her sister. Well, nobody knows her sister anyway here. Anyway, she was in treatment, and it had something to do with that, and they were going, probably, you know, the A&A was in the same building, and Al-Anon was upstairs, and she was in a good, safe environment. And the phone rang, and it was my mother-in-law, who had gone to Al-Anon with her, and she said, "Do you know where Sandy is?" I said, "No, I don't know where she is." And you know that burning sensation you get when you get phone calls about alcoholics or by alcoholics or you think it's going to be an alcoholic? That burning, rushing fear just crept in instantly. I thought, man, she took off. And my mother-in-law said, Sandy was at her Al-Anon meeting. She picked up her shoes. She didn't like wearing shoes. Picked up her shoes and her one day at a time, and she went downstairs. She says, "Chuck, I think she went to Alcoholics Anonymous." And where this came from, I have no idea. I said, maybe that's where she belongs. And it must have been where she belonged, because May the 18th, she celebrated 16 years of sobriety. And she still goes to those meetings. Well, not that particular meeting, because she has a sensitivity towards smoke now, but a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous to this day. So, yeah, I guess she went where she belonged. It wasn't my choice. It wasn't even her choice, I don't think. The God of understanding that works in our lives had a plan for us. Sandy was at AA. Man, ain't that great when your alcoholic starts going to A&A. I mean, it just isn't it wonderful? Life just returns to normal. Your problems are gone. There's food on the table every night. She's scrubbing the floors. Not. She starts going to this AA club. She starts listening to tapes. She's gone in the morning. She's gone in the afternoon. She's gone at night. She's being hauled around here by guys. She's taking her to meetings. Women are taking her to meetings. She comes to pick me up in the car. She had to have the car every day because she had to go to the club. And You know, and see, I was really grateful that she started going to AA, but I wasn't doing anything with the stuff that was inside of me. I had all these game pieces, anger, resentment, fear, all that was still in there. I just got kind of buried a little bit when this new thing happened. Well, she'd come to pick me up from work, and she'd be crying. She'd say, Sandy, what's the matter? I'm an alcoholic, and I just, you know. Oh, geez, I felt bad for her. Next day, she's come pick me up. Hey, Sam, what's going on? Oh, I'm happy, joyous, and free. I'm an alcoholic. Well, she'd be spaced out, and this happened. You know, I understand it happens to a few of you guys. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just crazy. You know? Well, I could accept that part of that thing. But she was going to be going into treatment. You know, she went to AA for like about 6 weeks. She was going to be going into treatment. We were sitting outside at the picnic table, straddling the bench, facing one another. And she says, I'm going to be going into treatment in a few weeks. And when I get out, we may not be together. Man, you could have slapped me in the stomach with a 2x4. I mean, we lived through hell for 13 years. Now she's sober, and she's telling me we may not be together. That ain't the way it works. And I tried my best to talk her out of it. The Courage to Change book, today's message, is about manipulation. Man, I was a master at that, and I still am, as a matter of fact. But I tried, well, it was positive manipulation too, you know. But I tried to talk her out of that, and she wouldn't do it. And she said, you know, Chuck, we don't know one another sober. We don't know one another sober. You know, we didn't. We didn't know each other sober. What an awakening. I hadn't expected that. And then she said something else to me at some point in time, and I don't remember exactly when this was. Chuck, my sobriety comes first. Then after that is you and the kids. What the hell are you talking about? Damn people got you brainwashed. Her dad told her that a few years before he died. She says, maybe my brain needed washing. He was a great guy. He had 40 years of sobriety with his plug in the jug. Anyway, she says, yeah, my sobriety comes first. See, I didn't understand. I didn't have recovery in my life. I didn't know what was going on. Well, she suggested I go to Al-Anon. She was bringing me that, you know, she was telling me that stuff. And I didn't want to go there, a bunch of old ladies sitting around, you know. I knew what that's. I read Ann Landers once in a while. I knew she wrote about Al-Anon in there. Well, when she told me we might not be together, I had this wonderful inspiration. Chuck, go to Al-Anon. So that night I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I'm going to share my first Al-Anon meeting with you. Maybe you can relate to this, maybe you can't. When I started school when I was 4 years old, kindergarten. My mom brought me to the school. She held my hand, and she brought me up the steps of school and knocked on the door, and this little old lady came out, a little kindergarten teacher, and she was about 111 years old. She had a blue suit on like this, a blue one, and she had a little snot rag tucked into her sleeve. I just remember it like it was yesterday. And my mom said, Chucky, this is Mrs. Bell. You're going in there to school. I'm going home, and she left me. Here we are, I'm 30-some years old, Sandy's got me by the hand, leading me up the steps of 1609 John Avenue, the damn building was breathing at me, I swear, come on in, just like the Amityville Horror thing, you know, got me inside that building, and it's beautiful, man, if you had the chance to go there, it's got all this hardwood paneling, and this circular staircase, and she said, Chuck, got me by the hand. Alcoholics Anonymous meets in these meetings, or in these rooms over here. Al-Anon's up the stairs, three doors down on the left, and I'm going to my meeting. And she let go of my hand. And I wanted to run. But I couldn't. I was in there, and there was people around. So I went upstairs and walked down the hallway to this third door, and there's a little smoke-stained sign on there, you know, Al-Anon. It was really cheerful looking. I mean, it was just this ugly-looking thing. And there's the door, and I thought, well, I gotta go in there. And I thought, this is what was going on behind that door. Maybe you can relate to this. This is what I heard behind that door. They were going, oh, God, man, I don't want to go in that place. I don't want to go through that door. That was scary. So this is, and I swear this happened to me. I went to push that door, and it's an old house. It's over 100 years old. Well, the top of the door would stick, and the bottom wouldn't. And the bottom would go in, the top wouldn't go in. And I thought, Jesus. And I pushed on that door, and my plan was to kind of slide around the real wall, you know. And I pushed on that door, and I went right into the middle of that room. And this one went, oh, it's another man, come on in.
What entered my mind immediately was, what the hell did he do with the other man? You know? Apparently there had been more going, but they weren't there. But there was one little old guy there, and he was a real tiny little guy, and I sat next to him, and he seemed big to me that night. And the next week, and I don't remember what was said. I do know I related to a lot of what was being said. Those people were talking stuff that went on in my life like they knew it, and it was new to me. The little old guy said, I'll take the meeting next week. I'll do the meeting. And I don't know how you guys do it around here, how you run your meetings. I'm sure it's similar, but the chairman takes the meeting, has a meeting topic. We go around the table and talk. But this guy, I didn't know that at the time. I thought, I'm coming back and listen to what he's got to say. So next Tuesday I went back, and he shared a story. He just started talking, he never shut up. And he was talking about the treatment centers and nut houses and state police and all, and that was his wife, you know, beating him up and putting him in the hospital and things. And he was smiling about it and happy, and he said he had been at Al-Anon for like 3 years or something. That was the last time I ever saw him. Never saw him again. He worked for the census, and he was in town for like 3 weeks and went to Al-Anon while he was there, and then he just disappeared and left. But it was enough to get me to keep coming back. And keep coming back I did. And I'm just so grateful that I did keep coming back, because it just started making differences in our life right off the bat. Shortly after that I started going to Al-Anon, and I can't remember how long it was, you know, it was a matter of weeks or maybe a month, we were sitting outside at that picnic table again, facing each other, and our neighbor comes over, our next door neighbor, wonderful lady, wonderful guy. They know everything. You don't wear dirty socks, they know that. They know you got some dirty socks on, and your dog poops in the yard, they know what time of the day it was. And they're wonderful people. She came over with two glasses of balloon wine. I don't know if you know what balloon wine is. Well, you stick some nasty stuff, it's good when it starts off, but you stick this stuff in a gallon jug, glass jug, and you put a balloon or something similar to a balloon over the top of it. And as this stuff starts working, and this balloon swells up. And then when it's done, the balloon starts to deflate, and then you can drink this stuff if you want to. Whoa, it's wicked. It's wine, but it's wicked wine. And she came over and she said, would you guys like a glass of wine? And we've got some sobriety. And as soon as I saw that red stuff in those glasses, my heart just cringed. And Sandy saw me, the look on my face, and she tells me that she thought I was saying no. And actually, I was just going, oh, no. We could not say no. We could not say no to that glass of wine. And we both drank it. Now, this neighbor, I chased Sandy around the block one night. Well, one night, I chased her around the neighborhood. In my underwear. Sandy drank up in our tree in the backyard. We had this big, huge piss elm tree in the backyard, and she used to drink up there in a state of undress. You know, if it was hot out, she'd go sit in the tree naked and drink. And the thing of it is, I never tried to stop her. And we're afraid to tell the neighbors we don't drink anymore. Oh, no, thank you, we don't drink. Oh, okay. Yeah, we didn't want to be embarrassed or anything, you know. Anyway, she took that drink of wine, and after Marge had left, she says, Chuck, I want to get drunk. And man, it just burned. She says, go get me a 12-pack. Which, isn't that interesting, too? Here she is, she's younger than me, healthier than me and everything else. She's telling me, go get me a 12-pack. And this is what I said. I said, Sandy, I can't do that for you. You'll have to call your sponsor. And I just burst out bawling. And then she started crying. And she calls me my love. And that just melts me right in my tracks. You know, and she says, good night, my love. She says, I've hurt you, my love. And I said, no, I just learned that I can't be responsible for your sobriety. And that I can't be responsible for you drinking or not drinking. And man, did we bawl. And she called her sponsor. Her sponsor come and got her and took her wherever alcoholic sponsors take their jittery little people. And she hasn't had a drink since that day on May 18th. And Sandy's sponsor was a woman that was familiar to us from the bars. Sandy and I grew up on the wrong end of town. We grew up about six blocks from one another, and thank God we didn't know each other until we were, you know, got married. We didn't even know each other when we got married, did we? We have known one another until about 6 years ago, actually. You know, it's taken time. Where was I? Sponsors. Sandy's sponsor. We knew Diane from the bars. Now, this was Sandy's spiritual advisor, this rather large woman. You ain't sticking your hand down looking for any money there, I'll tell you. Because Diane's idea of detachment was to rip a guy's arm off and beat him to death with it. She was mean. And I was Sandy's sponsor, and I thought, golly. But Diane was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 1609 John Avenue, she went to a lot of meetings. She was Sandy's sponsor, and she guided Sandy through the steps and left the program. And, you know, I can't understand alcoholics. I don't know about you guys. You know, I can't relate to what you do. And it takes another alcoholic to understand an alcoholic. That's why you got sponsors. Here I am, I'm on my own, you know, I'm going through this thing by myself, and I'm going to Al-Anon, it's getting kind of stale. And finally I got myself a sponsor. And you know, he's an Al-Anon guy. Al-Anons understand Al-Anons. I don't give a damn what Chip says. All these little blue cards on here that Chip Letterman reads, you know, I don't know. Al-Anons understand Al-Anons. I think you're pretty cool people, and you understand, you know, the hurt, you know, the embarrassment, you know, the behaviors that has gone on. And you know, Sandy and I, in our early sobrieties, sometimes I still hated her. Sometimes I still loved her. But I started working the steps, and I started working the traditions with the help of my sponsor, and I started going to a lot of meetings, and I'm a voracious reader. That's why I know about the history on the back of your flyer. I was sitting in the bathroom, I had to read something, I took that flyer with me, you know. I always go to the library and read. And I read that history, and it's really important. So I'm sucking up Al-Anon books like you wouldn't believe, and I'm reading that stuff. And if you're new in this fellowship and you think that you're getting kind of stale on it, look at your sponsorship role. You have a sponsor. You need one. You need one to work with you. It helps out so much. I sponsor a lot of guys. I shouldn't say that. Well, yeah, okay, I sponsor a lot of guys. I actively work with a number of guys. A few of those, a lot of guys, just kind of say, well, Chuck's my sponsor. I go to a meeting, and one of these guys will say, well, my sponsor said, and I look at him and think, when the hell did he get another sponsor? Because I never said that, you know. But it's so great. I was fortunate enough to attend a conference where one of the guys that I sponsored was an Al-Anon speaker. And I was filled with pride. It was like my kid, you know? And we're so damn much alike. It's scary. Greg and I are so much alike. Sponsorship's a wonderful opportunity. It's just enriched my life so much. And you know, if you don't have a sponsor, and I'm saying this because of my experience, don't be afraid to ask somebody. If you're 2, 3, 5, 7 years in this fellowship and you don't have a sponsor, it ain't no big thing. Just ask somebody. And if it don't work out, ask somebody else. I have a sponsor. My sponsor's name is Dave. Dave fits right here. 5'6". Bald as a cue ball. Little Frenchman. Yeah, and he's a little romantic Frenchman, too.
He talks like this.
Honestly,
he talks like this.
Well, anyway, Dave's my sponsor, and we work well together. We're different. He's got some ideas, and I've got some ideas. And even in our recovery, we've got some different ideas. He likes butterflies. I don't do butterflies. He's got a butterfly belt buckle. I'd afraid I'd hurt myself if I had something like that. Sandy thinks I'm bragging when I say that, but... I don't know. My dad died in 1990. He suffered from dementia for 13 years and passed away. I got the call at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the nurse gave me the information. He was in a nursing home for 13 years.
or 9 and 13 years. And I said, thank you. And I thank God for taking my dad because of what he went through and because of what was happening to him. It was a grace of God that he died. And you Alcoholics Anonymous people and these Al-Anon people that I joke about, who were so loving to us and just took us in and held us and helped us. Dave was there for me. On January 19th or 20th, the day escapes me right now, Sandy and I were, of 1991, we were out celebrating our 24th anniversary at an open Al-Anon meeting. We went out to supper. No alcohol. And we were planning on being romantic. No alcohol. We went out to supper. We went to an open Al-Anon meeting at the Information Service Center. Sat down and listened to the speaker. They were giving introductions, and a lady came up behind us who was our neighbor across the street, the person that we partied with. Her husband was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was in Al-Anon. She says, you guys better come with me because your dad's been hit by a car. So we took off, went to the hospital. Sure enough, that plug in the jug guy that I learned to love, he'd been struck and killed by a car crossing the street to get snuffed. And you know, I can make a humorous thing about that because, you know, my father-in-law, he was you understand, he's an alcoholic for 40 years. We always wanted to give up snuff. Dad, quit chewing that stuff, it's going to kill you. He said, young man, and he always called me young man. That's probably one of the reasons I liked him a lot. Call me young man. And he called Sandy little girl. He says, you know something? I could get killed walking across the street. He got killed walking across the street to get a can of snuff. And if he heard me say that today, he'd laugh. He would just have a belly laugh. He was a great guy. And his behavior, I detested. His manliness, his humanness, I loved. He was a friend to all, but had alcoholic behavior. Boy, is that important to find out, and you people taught me that. In April of 1991, I got a phone call. It was my sponsor, Dave. He says, Chuck, I need you, pal. I said, what's the matter? He said, I lost Justin. I said, what do you mean you lost Justin? Justin was his 15-year-old son. He had gone into treatment the day before. He came home and hung himself in his bedroom. And I said, Dave, I'll be right over. He lived over in Duluth. It's about 12, 15 miles from where we live. And on the way over there, I was throwing up prayers. I said, God, help me through this. I don't know what to do. I've never been in this situation before. Help me learn help me with what to say. I turn it over to you. I got there. I was the first Al-Anon person to get there. AA people started coming. And we just held Dave. We listened to stories. We listened to what he had to say about things. I didn't have to say anything profound. I was just there. And that's all we have to do, is be there for the other person. I read in Forum magazine a couple years ago, they said that, somebody wrote in and said that they were afraid that Al-Anon, there wasn't too much sharing going on anymore. And I'm here to tell you, I don't agree with that. Al-Anon saved our lives. Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous, has helped us save our marriage to healthy relationships. A few years ago, I don't know what I had going on with me. I was still fantasizing. I was still having problems with our relationship. I started hating that woman again. I didn't like her. She did this wrong, and she did that wrong, and she did this wrong, and she did that wrong. And there was a whole lot of other people there that did things better than she did, and I started looking at those other people and thinking they're doing it better than she's doing it, and I wish I had them instead of her. Sandy says, and I agree, when we get superficial with one another, we start spreading apart like oil on the water. And we had gotten superficial, and we got spreading apart. I went for some counseling. I did a fourth and a fifth step. I worked with my sponsor. And Sandy said to me, it's your choice. My choice. I don't do choices well. I don't do choices well. She said, you have a choice.
and this is very profound what she said, and I don't know if it's original or not. She said, let's say you have a necklace around your neck, and you have two precious stones on that necklace. She said, I'm one of those precious stones, and there's only room for one precious stone on that necklace. You make the choice. So I called my sponsor, and we went and talked. And you know what the first damn thing he said to me? Chuck, you got to make a choice. I wanted to reach over that table and choke him. I don't want to hear about choices. I said, yeah, but what about Sandy? What about the kids? What about this? What about that? He says, what about you? They'll deal with what they have to deal with. You make a choice for what you have to live with. And I made a choice. And we're together today. And we love one another. We love one another so much. We have a good life together. Today I understand, because what you people taught me, there's no prerequisite for alcohol and sex. We're romantic with one another today. We hold one another. We walk together. And the thing I learned was that if I concentrate on the negative ain't so much. You know, she might have 10 things that are negative. She might have 500 things that are positive. It's my choice of what to concentrate on. If I concentrate on the negative, that's what she's going to be. If she thinks I'm a turd, I'm a turd. In her eyes, yeah, that's the way it is. You know, I mean, that's anybody. If I don't like you because, you know, your hair is too long, I don't like you, no matter what you say to me. So it becomes my choice. Well, thanks to this program, I'm able to stand up here today and say Sandy and I are in love. And I hope that we're in love with the grace of God and the help of you people, that we can be open-minded and loving enough and caring enough for one another, allowing each other enough space to continue on together. Some people ask me why I go to Al-Anon. What do you keep going to that damn program for anyway? I mean, geez, you've been going for all these years. About time you quit. Well, this is a little story that illustrates why I keep going to Al-Anon. A couple years ago, I was working days at the time, which I don't do very often anymore, and Sandy cooked supper, which she doesn't do it very often anymore. And she made meatloaf, mashed potatoes, corn on the cob. Great supper, you know, that's great. I love mashed potatoes, and I love meatloaf and corn on the cob. We got this Three Seasons porch all glassed across the front, and the sun was coming through the porch, and I got home from work. We got knotty pine paneling in there, and I just got done doing it. Got these e-glass windows, you know, brand new windows, and double hung, you know. Going to sit down and eat in that porch. Had a little round table, real, you know, little round blue table with captain's chairs, just two. Very romantic. We sat down there, and we're looking at one another, and we started eating. Well, we had corn on the cob. And we started having this discussion on the proper way to butter this corn. You know, it's like do you take the pad of butter and butter it with your knife, or do you draw the cob through a quarter of butter, turning it as you do this, you know. One of us thought one way, one of us thought the other way, and you know, since I've told this story, I've learned a lot of ways to butter corn, I want to tell you. I'm not going to tell you who thought what was what, but anyway, we got into a less than open discussion about this thing, and I realized that I had to do something, because corn kernels were spitting out my mouth, and we were not practicing our principles at all, and I did the Al-Anon thing. I said, "The hell with you! I don't need this." And I threw my corn down in the middle of my mashed potatoes, and I got up and I left. And I took a walk. I walked down by the bay. We got a beautiful, beautiful Gulf here of Mexico, and beautiful white sand, but I don't think that you guys have anything over us as far as your white sand goes, because our beaches are white 6 months of the year, too. Along with our roofs and our sidewalks and the lakes themselves. Anyway, I took a walk down to the bay. We had just put our Labrador to sleep. She had cancer, and we had put her down, so she wasn't with me, and I'm walking down there, and there's a kid and a Labrador. He was throwing sticks, and she'd go in and get the sticks. I say she, I don't know what it was. Get the stick, throw it, get the stick. Walk a little bit further. There's a Blue Heron. You know, they crick their neck into an S, and they look down, and all of a sudden, phew, went down and got that fish, and come up, and that dirty bugger had his supper, and I didn't have mine, you know. I laughed about that, and I walked down a little ways to the bridge across, or railroad bridge across the river that Sandy used to drive across when I hated her guts. Looking down in that water, you know, thinking, I said the Serenity Prayer, and I'm thinking Al-Anon stuff. Honest to God, I am thinking Al-Anon stuff, and I thought, well, this is enough of this. I think it's time to go home. I think it's time to go home and say I'm sorry for my part in this silly argument. So I turned around to leave, and as I did that, fire trucks went by down the highway, about maybe a quarter of a mile away. And I watched the fire trucks and the ambulance and the cop car go by. And just for a fleeting moment in my mind, I thought, I hope the hell she thinks I jumped off the bridge and they're coming to pull me out. And I laughed about that. It's like my serenity is subject to change without notice. It's like those prices that are on the cereal boxes, you know. See the ad, but it's subject to change without notice. I turned around, I came home, and I told Sandy, I walked through the front door. And she said, hello. And I said, hi. She says, you want your supper? I said, yeah. I said, I want to apologize for my part in this argument. She says, yeah, me too. I didn't hate her. I didn't not like her. It was, we had an argument, we took some time, and we apologized. You guys taught me how to do that. The biggest thing you taught me was that you love the alcoholic and you hate the behavior. I didn't love and hate her. I loved her, and I hated the behavior. You guys taught me that. Nobody else, and I'm so grateful for that. And I'm going to say thank you very much for inviting Sandy and I to this Gulf Coast Roundup, and I hope someday that we can come back again. I don't want to spend another night in Memphis, although I would. We had a good time. But you people are wonderful, and I thank you very much.